Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Upon graduating from medical school, freshly minted doctors recite the Hippocratic Oath. Though the original Greek version does not contain it explicitly, modern versions of the oath include phrases about caring for all patients regardless of race, gender, sexuality, or economic status. Unfortunately, the world of medicine is no different than the rest of our culture, and racism persists in healthcare too. Sometimes it's overt, as with the photo on Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's med school yearbook page, featuring a photo of two students, one in blackface and one in a Klan outfit from the 1980s. Most of the time, it's more subtle, even implicit, in the assumptions we make about one another and cultural groups as a whole, and this is what's known as implicit bias. My guest today, Dr. Gibran Pasha, has studied the phenomenon of implicit bias and now offers an outstanding workshop on the topic, which he has delivered to a diverse array of audiences both locally and nationally. Dr. Pasha is a native Tulsan who's now on faculty at the OUTU School of Community Medicine, where he is a hospitalist in internal medicine. He also serves as an associate director of the internal medicine residency program and as director of pipeline programs for the medical school. Gibran Pasha also teaches students and residents in the art of bedside ultrasound, a technology that wasn't even available during my training, but has found increasing use to make healthcare safer and efficient. Dr. Gibran Pasha of the OUTU School of Community Medicine is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Gibran Pasha, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you talk about, for our listeners, what implicit bias is or what an implicit bias test is.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of a term that's really picked up some momentum the last several years. And at its basic form, implicit bias is when we have attitudes or beliefs that we're not aware of. So they're unconscious or subconscious. And even though we're not aware of them, they can still drive some of the decisions that we make. And so initially, it's really hard for people to kind of grasp that concept because you're thinking, how can there be something that I'm not aware of that's guiding my decisions?
And behavior to some extent, right?
Absolutely.
You do this, I think, in all realms, but particularly because you're a physician, you do it in the realm of medicine. And I came across you doing this through teaching staff, faculty, and students at the University of Oklahoma here in Tulsa. And so give us an example of a behavior in the medical world that could result from someone's implicit bias.
Yeah, so there's a lot of data that has kind of poured in on healthcare disparities and how a lot of those healthcare disparities are in part caused by physicians' implicit biases. And one thing that really stands out to me is one where they found that children who present to their pediatricians for behavioral issues. They've looked at identical cases where African-American children present with certain symptoms of misbehavior and white children present with symptoms of misbehavior. And they found that African-American children are much more likely to be diagnosed with just that, behavioral problems, where white children are much more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD, which is a clinical diagnosis that can potentially be treated with medication. And so that means some children who would benefit from some of these ADHD meds are not being prescribed them because some of the physician's bias is that, this kid, he's just misbehaving.
So it's almost like the framework is different. Yeah. So, I mean, and again, it's implicit, so it's not something that until it's been studied has been really looked at. But so pediatrician may see a white kid or the parents may have done some reading or something, or may the parent, you know, and says, I think my kid has ADHD, and come in and be very suggestive. And this is interesting. So the data, this research is showing us that on average, kids with similar behavior patterns, just based on essentially the color of their skin, a white kid may be in this medical framework, medicalized, whereas an African-American child may be labeled misbehaving and thus with all the attendant problems that gives, school suspensions, falling behind, less likely to graduate, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes well beyond race. That's a big part of it. And I think it's something that makes people uncomfortable, the whole discussion of race. And so we do need to talk about it. But it encompasses a lot of other things, too. Another really important data set that they've grabbed is that women are much more likely to not get referred for joint replacement surgeries than men. And the thought is because there's an inherent bias in many physicians that, well, the woman doesn't really need to be out in the workforce. So we don't really need to do a knee replacement on her because she doesn't really need to be up on her feet as much. And so, you know, there's tons and tons of data that are very similar to that. Women not being recognized of having signs and symptoms of heart attacks or heart disease, based on the notion that some physicians just don't realize that women are at risk for heart disease as well. And so even though they present with the clues and the symptoms, that if it was a man, we say, hey, that definitely are signs and symptoms of heart disease. For whatever reason, it doesn't trigger that same response oftentimes when it's a female.
So I remember seeing those studies, at least, and there was even a randomized control trial, I think, where in the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago now, where they had a white male, a white woman, a black male, and a black woman all present with essentially the exact same symptoms. And yet in this, you know, I think it was dozens or hundreds of doctors, the outcomes were markedly different. I mean, it was the white males that most often got referred for cardiac cath, which is kind of the most invasive diagnostic test you can do to determine as factually as possible that someone has blockage in one of their coronary arteries. But the women in particular, and particularly the African-American women, were the least likely to be referred for coronary cath. Just the way you talked about women in general, I didn't even know that about joint replacement surgeries. And it's really interesting. So how did you get interested in this work?
Just by chance. And I can't even remember exactly what the moment was that triggered me to be really interested in this. I was doing some research of something totally unrelated and stumbled upon an article when I did a literature search and I started reading about it. And it really pulled me in that direction. And I looked at it and I said, you know, amidst everything that was going on in our society here in the last few years with officer-involved shootings, the racial undertones in politics, I said, well, this is something that I can really get on top of and make a difference in my own field of work in medicine, just like it can be applied to the workforce, criminal justice system. There surely are places where we can apply this in medicine. And so I have a really easy avenue to this where, you know, I do medical education. I thought, how about we put together a workshop where we're talking about implicit bias and race and gender with our medical students and our residents? One, because I think everyone should start to get comfortable with those discussions. And two, because the data is so strong that, you know, we think of physicians of being kind of in a moral class of our own. We're not any different. We still are subject to some of these biases. So I saw a very easy avenue to kind of start talking about some of these things. And my goal was to start to remove some of the barriers, because there's often a natural barrier that goes up when you start to talk about race or you start to talk about implicit bias. And finding ways to kind of remove these barriers is probably paramount for this workshop to work. And so who says that it can't be fun or that it can't be funny or, you know, that you can't kind of have some self-deprecating humor kind of wrapped up into it? And when you do all that, you can see those walls kind of come down and it just makes the workshop so much better.
Well, I was fortunate enough to attend sort of a miniature, a one-hour version of your workshop that you presented at OU recently during Black History Month. And one thing I wondered was how much resistance do you get? I mean, is it the kind of thing, I would imagine, where a lot of people come and say, oh, I don't have any bias. And so, like you say, it's a little bit of a hot button issue and people's walls go up and they say, well, this is not me, this is the other. I don't judge people. But you use a tool, the implicit association test, I think, and what you find out is, yeah, you pretty much have these biases and everybody has them. It's not like just because you're the facilitator or you're the one doing this research or you're the one presenting. And as you point out, it can be fun. And I thought you did a great job of, as you said, self-deprecating and showing, you know, you have biases too. And so it's sort of like it makes the audience a little more comfortable, like, oh, this guy's standing up here and he's admitting that he found out through this process that he has some biases too. And so you've done it enough times now, have you had people who just are stalwarts and say, I don't have a bias? Or do you find that people's defenses are able to come down through the process of the workshop? I guess it's all things.
Yeah. I think one thing I've noticed is that usually after, I've probably done this 10 sessions or so, give or take, and almost after every session, one or two people come up just to kind of talk about things. And they, most of the time they reveal, hey, I didn't even think this is possible. I've considered myself an egalitarian kind of person with my views being equal. And, you know, I love everyone. I don't see color. That's a comment that's made a lot. And then they say, but, you know, this workshop has kind of opened my eyes to the fact that just like many people, I have my own inherent biases as well. And one part that I also try to stress in this workshop that helps people open up their minds to this possibility is that just because you have implicit biases against someone of a different race or someone of a different color or different sexuality doesn't mean you're a racist or a sexist or a bigot. It means that your brains work the exact same way as everyone else's brains do. And that puts us all at risk for having these biases. And so recognizing this as a possibility is like the first step, and then you can start to act on it. And before I really got into this, I didn't really give a whole lot of thought about that. I consider myself one of these people that loves everyone and thinks everyone should be treated equal. But then as I started doing this work, I would catch these thoughts that would kind of bubble to the surface. And now I have the ability to catch them before something comes out of my mouth or before that thought really comes to fruition. And one experience I had that really stood out was one day I was at the hospital, was at the nurse's station on the patient chart, and I looked up and there was a young black kid who probably was, you know, 19, 20 years old. He had tattoos on his neck, had tattoos all over his arms, and he was in a hospital gown. And he's walking towards the nurse's station, and I just had this fleeting, quick thought of, huh, I wonder if he got shot. And it just almost like punched me in the chest when that thought came up, because I said, well, why would I think that? And it was clear to me that a young black kid with tattoos, for me, had an association with violence. And it was much, much more likely that he wasn't there for some sort of, you know, violent experience. He might have had a gallbladder problem or some sort of infection. But that really grabbed me and said, well, I clearly can benefit from these trainings as well. And so that's one thing I do in this workshop is I say, look, these are some of the experiences I've had. There have been experiences where I have had my own biases come forward. There's been several experiences where someone else's bias has come forward to me. And now that I have this different frame of reference, I have a different viewpoint, where in the past I would think, well, that person really seems like they're maybe racist with what they said or how they acted. But now I can kind of give people the benefit of the doubt and say, well, maybe this is just bias kind of rearing its ugly head.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jabron Pasha, who's an assistant professor of medicine at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. He is also a faculty hospitalist, and we're discussing his work on implicit bias. He conducts a workshop for professionals, for students, for residents on the subject of implicit bias. And Jabron, you pointed out that we all have biases, but it doesn't mean we're racist or sexist. But it's a little bit how the human brain works, right? So our brains are incredible organs, and we just make associations. So you gave the example of you saw a young African-American male in the hospital with tattoos and things, and you had an association with violence. And it's like almost like we're conditioned to that by whether it's the news media or whether it's the TV shows and movies we watch. It's in the culture. And fortunately, because you're more sensitized to this and have done this training, you said it was a punch in the gut. You felt you were making a prejudgment on this person. But that's how our brains work. And so when we think women, drivers, or that's a terrible stereotype, but that's just how our minds work. We cluster and we make associations. And so these things aren't necessarily bad, but they can be, right? I mean, that's how we make these mental shortcuts is really what they are.
Yeah, that's the exact term that I use, it's mental shortcuts. And if you thought about the possibility of our brains trying to analyze every piece of information that comes in every second, millions of data points are coming into our brains every second. And so there's literally no way for the brain to analyze that. We would be incapacitated, right? So the brain is able to compartmentalize, make mental shortcuts, put things in categories so we can make these snap judgments. And there's probably an evolutionary component to that, where if you were a caveman and you saw a bear coming at you, you know, you see this big furry thing, danger, right? You don't have time to sit there and really break down the situation. And so I think a lot of that is just born from, hey, fight or flight. You got to make these quick decisions and quick justifications for your actions. And so that makes it really hard to combat, because we are literally wired that way to handle certain data and compartmentalize things. And sometimes it's completely harmless. You're in the hospital, you see someone turn the corner in a long white coat, that's a doctor, right? But when we apply those to other situations, like you're walking down the street and you see a young black male, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person is a violent person or anyone you need to be afraid of, right? And so these mental shortcuts can cause a lot of issues in the form of bias.
So I wanted to ask you about something. So in the news, there was this issue with the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, who is a physician, who had a medical school yearbook photo on his page of two people, one in blackface and one in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. And we shared this column by Dr. Ann Arthur Andrew, who is a Brooklyn ophthalmologist, and she is an African-American woman and a physician. And she wrote how painful this Governor Northam incident was to her because she talked about being in medical school in the 1980s, I think it was, and how she, whether implicit or explicit bias, she was many times made to feel less than because she was black and because she was a woman. And she wrote this very personal column. Have you experienced that in, as a medical professional, where people, you know, essentially are judging you on the color of your skin before they even meet you or know you or mischaracterize you?
You know, I consider myself pretty fortunate in that avenue that I don't have any glaring or scary or depressing stories of being a medical student and experiencing outright racism. I have many classmates that would have multiple stories on that front. One story that does stand out, and then this is, I was several years out of residency at this point, and again, I'm hesitant to say this was racism. I think it had a lot to do with what we were talking about, implicit bias, unlike the whole Governor Northam situation, where I think a lot of that is outright racism. You got someone with the Ku Klux Klan hat on and outfit next to someone in blackface. That's not bias. That's racism, in my opinion. But I do have an experience that I had, and this was a couple years ago. I was in the hospital, and I was walking into the emergency department to see a patient who we're going to admit. And I had, I had my scrubs on, had my badge, I had my stethoscope around my neck. And as I walked in, the patient I was seeing, he was in bed. I think he was sleeping, older gentleman. And his wife, who I'd probably say was probably in her 80s, was on the telephone. And she looked my way when I walked through the door, and her first response was, quote, "What do you want?" And I was kind of taken aback there for a little bit. And I said, "Well, I'm Dr. Pasha. I'm here to see Mr. So-and-so." And you could tell she had not even thought about the possibility of me being the treating physician. And she then became very apologetic, and I'm sure she was embarrassed. And so she's not accustomed to seeing a young black physician. And that was clear. She thought I was, I don't know, someone in the service department there, and which doesn't justify her actions at all. But that I do remember as kind of, and it wasn't something that severely affected me. I'm not trying to paint that picture, but you notice those sort of things.
Yeah. Jabron, I want to shift gears for a second because you are also an instructor in the medical school. You teach a clinical ultrasound. And this is really interesting to me because when I trained, ultrasound was purely the realm of really radiologists who used ultrasound to diagnose abdominal pain complaints or fluid issues. And then, of course, OBGYNs use ultrasound all the time to look at fetuses or babies inside their mother's womb. But you use ultrasound in completely different ways. And this was a little bit part of your training, but you've really dived in deep on this. And so now you are really one of the key instructors at the OUTU School of Community Medicine in terms of teaching ultrasound. So how does this work exactly?
Yeah, and you were a big part of that. it's been a skill that I've developed over the last several years, and it really has come in handy. I think the best way to explain it is that, as you kind of mentioned, the traditional way that we would use ultrasound in the past was, hey, doc, I have a pain in my stomach. It's right upper quadrant pain. Okay, well, the doctor says, all right, we need to get an ultrasound. We'll send you to the ultrasound suite. The sonographer, who was actually trained, they went to school to use ultrasound, will do the ultrasound on your gallbladder. They will then send those images to the radiologist. The radiologist will read the images, and then eventually the report will get back to your primary care physician. And whenever your primary care physician has a few minutes, they'll give you a call and tell you the results. And as you can imagine, and as many of you know, that takes a lot of time. It can be hours, it can be days, it can sometimes be weeks for that whole process to go from start to finish. This new way of doing it, and I say new, it's probably been around for 10, 12 years, but it's really starting to pick up, is called point-of-care ultrasound. And basically what makes point-of-care ultrasound special is it puts the ultrasound probe in the hands of the treating provider. And so I can go see a patient in the hospital who's complaining of that same right upper quadrant pain. I roll the ultrasound machine in there. I take a look at the gallbladder. I see that the gallbladder is inflamed and it has gallstones, and I can call surgery and they can have that gallbladder out in a couple of hours. And so it can really streamline things. It can make medical care a lot more efficient. The patient experience improves because of that efficiency. And we can also make other really quick clinical decisions with ultrasound. And so, as you know, we started with our internal medicine residents integrating this point of care ultrasound into our residency program. And so now all of our residents who graduate from our program walk out with some really tangible ultrasound skills. And from that, we've myself and a colleague, Dr. Lori Whalen, who's an ER physician with us, integrated the ultrasound curriculum into the medical school curriculum. And so there are not a lot of schools across the country. The majority of schools across the country don't have an integrated ultrasound curriculum in their medical school program, especially not first years and second years. And so we're doing some pretty great things over at our School of Community Medicine, where our students are actually getting ultrasound training literally the first few weeks that they step on campus.
So is there pushback from radiologists who say, you know, you're not really qualified to do this, or you don't do it enough to where you're certain of the imagery that you're looking at? Or, like, I mean, how does that play out? I have no idea.
Yeah. As you would anticipate, when this technology and this methodology first started, there was pretty significant pushback from our radiology colleagues with, you know, reasonable concerns. But since point of care has really become a little bit more mainstream, they've had the opportunity to gather a lot of data on, well, how easy is it to teach? And they found that the teachability of ultrasound is really high. And they've done studies and they found that a few really dedicated hours of ultrasound training in specific applications leaves the provider with really good skills and efficiency in ultrasound. And so once we're able to say, hey, we can safely train our practitioners to do it, and that we can make the patient experience better, we can make the healthcare experience a lot more efficient, and we can actually change outcomes with it, it doesn't leave a whole lot of room for reasonable pushback.
You grew up in Tulsa, right?
Yeah, born and raised.
And you were a Booker T. Washington High School graduate.
Proud Hornet.
Well, congratulations. They won yet another state basketball championship. And then so what led you, I guess, back to Tulsa to become a doctor?
Yeah, so I, it would be fair to say that I grew up in Tulsa and I didn't really leave Tulsa a whole lot. We weren't a family that traveled a lot. And so I was, you know, basically here through high school. You know, I decided, you know, when I was getting close to graduation that I at least should get out of the state for a little bit, but I didn't want to go too far. So I went to University of Kansas. My family, both my mom and dad's families are from Kansas City, so it kind of put me close to family, but far enough away from home where I felt like I was actually away and able to kind of do my own thing for a little bit, if you will. And so after undergrad, I stayed at KU for medical school. Then I finally got out of the Midwest and went to Mayo Clinic, Arizona for residency. And I was there for 3 years, and I think got great training, met a lot of great people. I enjoyed living in Arizona, but I really missed home. And Tulsa's much different, as you may have heard, now than it was in 2002 when I graduated high school. I think we've got great leadership. People are really putting money back into the city. Young people are moving back into the city. What they've done with downtown and the Gathering Place and the various industries that are really growing here has really made Tulsa, for me, a place that I really have no intentions of leaving. My family's all here. My wife's family's here. And so I'm really happy to be home.
I want to ask one more thing about your career, because it's really taken some interesting directions. And so you are a director and involved with admissions, I think, at the medical school, and particularly in something called pipeline programs. And so essentially, I think 6% of medical students across the country are African Americans. So not only underrepresented in general, but very underrepresented even as they are a percentage of the population. So this is a big problem, because we know that doctors from underserved communities tend to go back and practice in those communities more than, say, majority or white physicians will. And so it's obviously then becomes very important to get culturally competent physicians, whether they be from the African American community or Spanish speaking community or any other number of immigrant communities to the U.S. We need to diversify the pool of students in medical school. And so what are some of the programs that you've been working on?
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting for people to know that when you compare today to the 1970s, there are actually less African Americans in medical school
now
yeah. than there were in the 1970s, which is really hard to believe. And it's not because of the universities and the medical schools. They have really, a lot of programs have really got on board with this push for diversity. And so you look at it, so what's the problem? And the problem is that there really hasn't been a significant increase in the applicant pool for minorities. And so that's why there's a significant need for pipeline programs. Because you can have a university who's very willing and eager to increase the diversity of their enrollment, but if you don't have the people applying, it doesn't really make a difference.
You can't let them in if they don't apply.
Exactly. And so what pipeline programs do is that they start to introduce young kids to various fields at a young age. And so with our pipeline programs, we have several, but the two that I really value the most are our program called Club Scrubs, which is a OU Tulsa program where we have high school students from all across the city who come spend some time with us two times a month in the evenings and get exposed to everything medicine. Not just, hey, come learn about being a doctor or come learn about being a nurse. We expose them to, you know, physicians, nursing, physical therapy, EMT, paramedics, all different kinds of careers in the medical field. So one, they can just get comfortable with that. The other thing I think is important is for them to see someone like me, who looks like a lot of our students, who is a physician. Sometimes just the power of saying, oh, wow, he looks like me, maybe I can do it, is enough to at least spark their interest. And so with our pipeline programs, we're hoping to increase the pool of eligible, not only minorities, but other people who are, other students who are from who would be first-generation college students, those from social economic disadvantaged groups, to let them know, hey, we're trying to even the playing field because it's not even. And I think the numbers show that in 2019, there are not any more minorities in medicine and in the medical schools than it was, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it just shows how intentional you have to be about this work and how you really have to stay at it. It's not like you can hit a threshold number and say, oh, well, we've done it. We've achieved equality or we've achieved proportionality, and thus we're good to go. You know, and it, clearly, that I think the data from med school demographics now shows we're not anywhere near where we need to be.
Yeah, and it's tough because you don't get any immediate feedback, right? These pipeline programs are not going to be proven successful till, you know, these kids, some of these kids are freshmen in high school, right? So you got 4 years of high school, you got 4 years of college. We're looking at 10, 12, 14 years before you can start to say, hey, these pipeline programs are working. And so it takes a whole lot of work up front. It takes a whole lot of patience to really stay with it and kind of trust the process. And so we're hoping, you know, that we see some of these kids in our Club Scrubs programs years from now be walking across the stage getting their white coats.
That'd be great. Well, Gibran Pasha, it's been absolutely great to talk to you and learn a little bit about the work that you're doing. And congratulations on all that work. It's obviously very meaningful and very important for the medical community and for our community in Tulsa. And we're lucky that you decided to come back to Tulsa to practice here. So thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's been a blast.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.